Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning into The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, June 26. Today we're bringing you a show highlighting stories about Title IX, the 1972 federal law prohibiting federally funded educational institutions from discrimination based on gender. We highlight the story of its champion, Patsy Mink. Fierce and Fearless, we look back at her biography written by her daughter, Wendy. And a short documentary shares the forgotten story tied to Title IX involving a New York car crash and a revote in Washington, D.C. We revisit our conversation with the standout athlete whose career was given a big foot up because of the Equality in Education Act. And we recall when female athletes from Campbell High School settled a Title IX class action lawsuit against the Hawaii Department of Education. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. For more than five decades, the legacy of equality in education has been upheld by these 37 words. No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Fierce and Fearless, Patsy Takemoto Mink, First Woman of Color in Congress, is the title of a biography that was released in 2022. We hanaho our conversation with her daughter, Wendy Mink, as well as co-author and historian Judy Wu. We hear from Mink first.
The book was a pretty long time in the making. Probably concretely, I started sort of puttering around the rather massive collection of her papers that are housed at the Library of Congress around 2007, 2008. I started to work a little more systematically, maybe around 2010, 2011. So I was sort of on my way to try to figure out how to tell her story in a biography. But I kept running up against sort of a problem of not being entirely certain about what voice to use in the narrative. And by that, I mean using the voice of a daughter, making it more of a kind of memoir, or using the voice of a political scientist, which is what I'm trained to do. And as those two sort of pulls and pushes were at war in my psyche, suddenly, just from, you know, a gift from the universe, landed in Washington, D.C., and her name was Judy. And we got together and exchanged ideas and developed an intellectual relationship, and that was about 2012. And so for the past 10 years, we've been collaborating, working together on this project that culminated in the book.
And Judy Wu happens to be on the line with us from California. Judy, so what was it like, working on this? Because, you know, there's so much information, and you want to, you know, pay homage to all that she's achieved. And what she's done for women. So what was that like for you?
Oh, it's been an honor to be able to write about her life. I had known of Patsy Mink, but I was looking for a project to work on, and I discovered the Library of Congress website. They were featuring her papers. And as a historian, it's always exciting to know that there's archival material. But I didn't realize how much material there were. There are about 2,700 boxes. So it's a little bit daunting, but it's been wonderful to be able to collaborate with Wendy. I would go to Washington, D.C., look in the archives, and she lives just down the street. So I would go to her place afterwards and talk to her, and she would say, oh, this is what was going on in our lives. This is what was happening. And so I so appreciate those conversations. I originally was planning to interview her, and we did do a series of interviews. But when I found out that her mother wanted Wendy to write her biography, I just thought that we needed to collaborate. And so it's been a fantastic experience to be able to be in partnership together, but also have our distinct voices. Each of the chapters begins with a really moving and powerful vignette from Wendy, and then I get to do the historical analysis. And it's been really helpful to have her perspective on what I'm writing so that I can do justice to Patsy Mink.
And Wendy, I don't know, do you have a favorite chapter in the book?
My favorite part depends on my mood and the alignment of the stars from day to day. But I do frequently come back to a chapter that deals with my mother's work, her national service in the aftermath of losing the 1976 Senate race. She goes to the State Department as an Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans and Scientific Affairs, and after an interesting but brief experience there, goes on to become president of the Americans for Democratic Action. And Judy does a wonderful job juxtaposing the challenge of working within a very brittle and rigid bureaucracy, the State Department, and then working with grassroots progressive politics in the ADA. And the result is a fascinating story of sort of two sides of the American political process, really, if you want to step back and look at the big picture. So most of the time I end up sort of landing on that chapter as my favorite.
Your mother gave great speeches. You know, I mean, I covered her as a City Hall reporter when she returned from D.C. and was her council member. I just remember just being in awe of her, you know, after doing all this great work in the nation's capital, coming back home. But still being very passionate about what she believed in, you know. And I remember covering, you know, her speeches when she led the recall for the three Honolulu city councilmen who switched parties, and you know, was just so amazed that, you know, she just figured, you know, this was wrong, and she was just going to make sure that the right thing was done. But I don't know. Do you have any favorite speeches?
There were so many that were very provocative and evocative. I remember some of her commencement addresses at high schools, like Roosevelt High School, Kaimuki High School, or whatever, in the 1960s, during the height of the Vietnam War. I don't remember the language of it particularly at this moment, but I do remember being, you know, moved listening to her. Sometimes she had to give those speeches long distance over the telephone because of events that were transpiring on the East Coast. I think one she had to do Kaimuki High School, maybe, because Robert Kennedy was assassinated and his funeral, she wanted to attend his funeral services. So she called in to Kaimuki and they piped her over the loudspeaker. I remember those speeches. I think Judy has actually memorized certain passages of speeches that speak strongly to her spirit. I don't know, Judy?
I don't have them memorized, but she was such an amazing speech giver. When I look at film clips, she's so passionate, articulate. And I was just talking about this earlier in the week. She wrote out longhand her speeches. I, you know, when I ask something, I type bullet points or I use a computer, but she wrote out incomplete sentences, pretty much the final form when she on pads. I think overall, I just love her spirit. Catherine, what you described is exactly right. One of the speeches, that's the name of Kimberly Bassford's documentary about Patsy Mink, is entitled Ahead of the Majority. And she talks about the need for political courage, that you can't wait for issues to be popular before you support them, that you have to take a stand. And I think that is something that persists throughout her life. I think she also, in addition to being a political leader, she was really interested in educating other people to become active citizens. We quote from her last speech about Title IX, which was given on the 30th anniversary of Title IX. And she talks about how this is one of the greatest achievements of her political career. But she also emphasized that it's not just a one and done process, that after you pass the law, there's the effort to maintain the law, to maintain the spirit of creating change and working towards social justice. And so that all of us have to be vigilant. We can't just take these opportunities for granted. And I also really love the period that you're describing when you covered her. And that was one of my big surprises. I knew more of her legislative achievement when she was in the House of Representatives from 65 to 77 and 1990 to 2002. But that period of her life when she was in between these terms of service, I was just so blown away by the fact that she was just as committed, just as vocal on the Honolulu City Council as she was in the halls of Congress. She was remarkably consistent in her commitment towards transparency, democracy, creating equal opportunities. She's someone who I think we can learn so much from and to look up to.
You know, and I think when I pass by the statue there across from Honolulu Hale, you know, it's there in front of the Hawaii State Library, it is really delightful to see people discover it and to read the plaque and to just, you know, pause and reflect on, you know, what she's done for, you know, for Title IX. And, you know, today we're still grappling with these issues. You know, you hear of the women's, I think it was the water polo team that can't get in the pool and have to do land exercises because they don't have, you know, equal time. You know, the girls don't have locker facilities like the boys do. You know, we're still dealing with that here in Hawaii, even after all this time has passed. I don't know, Wendy, you want to chime in here about the progress that we have made and we still have far to go?
Right. I mean, there's evidence of great strides in the, you know, expansion of women's athletic activities, in the expansion in the numbers of women in law schools and medical schools, in the very slow but moving in the right direction integration of the workplace in what used to be referred to as men's jobs and that sort of thing as a result of gender equity and skills training or attempts to enforce that. But there are so many ways in which lack of equity pervades the educational experience that my mother's call for vigilance in 2002 on the 30th anniversary remains the call that we need to remember today. I applaud the student athletes, the students interested in sports who have raised the issue in the state of Hawaii schools. The same issues are being raised across the country by girls who are trying to pursue phys ed and athletic activities. The same similar issues that affect equity are being raised across the country with sexual harassment in the educational process. Collateral issues are being raised for pregnant and parenting students, and so forth. There are still lots of manifestations of inequality, lots of roadblocks to equity in the schools, but we do have Title IX, which is a powerful lever for redressing those problems. The issue really is that everybody needs to know that Title IX is out there. Everybody needs to know how to access its potential in pursuing complaints and raising issues and the like. And we need to enforce the pledge of equity in education for everyone equally at all levels of schooling.
Well, one of my favorite stories is I think you had mentioned that I think you had wanted to run for class president when you were young. And I think a teacher had said, oh, you know, maybe you should run for vice president.
That was in second grade. I wanted to run for just, you know, the classroom president. The teacher wanted to, I guess, have us all participate in a civic exercise or something like that. So we were having candidates run for office, and I wanted to run for classroom president. I was a little mini me, you know. I was, you know, emulating my mother and so forth as a candidate. And the teacher told me that I couldn't because a boy wanted to be president. A boy wanted to run, and he should be the one who got to be elected, and that I should be his helpmate as vice president if I wanted to serve.
Ouch.
Yeah. Yeah.
And out of stories like that, we have Title IX, the law of the land for education equity, thanks to Hawaii's Patsy Mink. We've been hearing from Mink's daughter, Wendy Mink, and historian Judy Wu. We first aired this conversation in June of 2022. Since then, Patsy Mink's portrait was unveiled in our nation's capital and is on permanent display at Statuary Hall. And we thought it fitting to hear from Patsy Mink herself. Here's an excerpt of a 1984 speech where she's addressing the Democratic National Convention.
The women's agenda is not a special interest agenda. Women's rights are about fundamental justice, not only about laws and court orders, but about the way women are treated and regarded in this country, at the workplace and in the marketplace, and at all levels of economic and political life. Let us, women everywhere in America, because we care, create a stampede to the Democratic ballot box in the name of peace, economic justice, and equality, and because our time has finally come.
That was Patsy Mink back in 1984. But did you know, two decades earlier, a critical vote almost reversed the equality effort? There was a proposed change to Title IX called the Casey Amendment, which would have gutted critical verbiage, which would have changed the outcome of funding to women's athletic programs. Oscar award-winning independent producer Ben Proudfoot made it the subject of a New York Times documentary short released in the summer of 2022.
So I was making the film The Queen of Basketball, which is about Lucy Harris, who is the first and only woman officially drafted into the NBA. And her life story was, you know, inextricably connected to the passage of Title IX, which spawned the creation of the women's team at her local college in Mississippi. So I was trying to track down, you know, which photo or clip I wanted to use for the establishment of Title IX. And it kind of led me to Richard Nixon being the guy who signed it. And I was like, it just doesn't add up, everything I know about Richard Nixon, that he would be the champion of women athletes. So I just dug a little, like, not that much deeper, and it was pretty clear that, you know, there were others who were in charge of the writing and defending of Title IX that were not Richard Nixon. I don't think he had anything to do with it, really. And the name Patsy Mink rose to the top, and I believe she's actually the name for the actual legislation, the Patsy Mink Quality in Education Act. And as I was researching Patsy, I came across this story, amazing story, really, about this critical moment when Title IX was being defended from the male sports lobby that wanted to gut it. And her daughter, Wendy, got into a life-threatening car accident on the day of the vote, and she was whisked away from Congress. And as I read about this, I just thought, my God, this is such a dramatic story. And thought it would be a great film. Wendy was a great storyteller in recounting this event that happened, you know, almost 50 years ago, in which this key vote was interrupted because she had gotten into a car accident in upstate New York. And the vote that Patsy left the room for actually lost by one vote, Patsy's vote. And so if that verdict had stood, they later brought it to the revote. But if that vote had stood, physical education would have been carved out of Title IX, and sort of that integrity of Title IX's efficacy in the athletics realm would have been corrupted, and probably many more dominoes would have fallen. So it was a very dramatic moment that Wendy took us through that really was a huge moment in American history that she was unwittingly a part of.
And so your documentary, where does that live?
You can watch it on the New York Times, and you can watch it on the New York Times YouTube channel as well for free.
That was documentary filmmaker Ben Proudfoot talking about the 2022 short documentary entitled Mink. Here's an excerpt from the film, which features Wendy Mink, whose car crash in her Pinto in upstate New York almost derailed Title IX as we know it now. Here's Wendy explaining how her mother missed a critical vote on a key amendment.
The future of equality in some large way was on the table that day. The vote gets underway. Meanwhile, I got in the car. An oncoming car crashed into us. Phone call comes to her on the floor. Your daughter's unconscious in intensive care. I got the brunt of impact. The ultimate family versus career moment. That my mother was even in the hospital with me, given the stakes of what was happening in Washington, D.C., seems sort of insane to me. The Casey Amendment wins 212 to 211. It lost by one vote. My mom's vote. S. The windshield flew at me. All the glass fell. It cut my face. Here. Yeah, it's all along here, side of my mouth. I'm sure the male athletics lobby were celebrating on the night of the 16th, but things were happening. Her colleagues in Congress, especially Congresswoman Abzug of New York, who was a good friend, fought in her absence. Many expressed concern for what was going to happen to me. Even a substantial number of pro-Casey people. Yeah. It was the speaker's decision, Speaker Carl Albert of Oklahoma. He always said, Patsy and I see eye to eye, because they were both short. I mean, he was a short man. Given my mother's abrupt departure, thought about it, considered it, and decided. Revote. Many on the other side came around. So in the end, 215 to 178 in favor of deleting the Casey Amendment from the Education Appropriations Bill. My mom won, girls and women won, feminists won. Yes. No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. That is called Title IX.
Getting into school and getting into the professions, I couldn't find a job. And when all of my contemporaries at home say, oh my goodness, what you've done to politics at home, and you know, I wish we had never heard of Patsy Mink, I'll say, well, it's because of all of your attitudes that drove me into politics. If you'd given me a job when I came home from law school, I would have been very happy.
I am the child of someone who made a huge difference for women and girls in education. She taught me change might be slow, but changes can happen. I did screw it up with the Pinto, right? For 2 days.
We've been hearing from Patsy Mink's daughter, Wendy. She spoke about a critical moment for Title IX legislation. It was part of a short New York Times documentary titled Mink. If you're just joining the conversation, we're airing a special broadcast about Title IX in Hawaii. Coming up, Law in Action. We hear from the lead plaintiff who settled a class action lawsuit against the Hawaii Department of Education. Now, Campbell High School girls have the same opportunities, access, treatment, and benefits in high school sports as boys. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
Aloha, this is Derek Malama. Please join me for the first episode of Kanikapila Vintage, the new podcast from HPR featuring classic interviews from Kanikapila Sunday. We're kicking off the series with the Brothers Casimero at the legendary Mountain Apple Studios from 2004. It's available this Thursday, wherever you get your podcast. Sponsored by Manu Healii.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
In a case that took nearly 5 years, a Title IX lawsuit in Hawaii's public schools was settled in 2023. We brought you that story when it first unfolded. The ACLU sued Campbell High School and the Oahu Interscholastic Association for failing to provide equal treatment for a girls' sports program. As we reflect on the 54th anniversary of Title IX, we hanaho our conversation after the case settled. We spoke with ACLU's legal director, Wookie Kim, and Campbell alum, Ashley Badise, who was the lead plaintiff in the case. Badise was on the girls' water polo team and recalled being forced to change in the restrooms of a nearby fast food restaurant because of the lack of a girls' locker room. And 1 year, the team didn't get to practice in a pool prior to their first game. We start with Kim.
This is a significant milestone because, you know, this is a recognition that gender equity in our schools when it comes to athletics is something that's important and something that the Department of Education and the Oahu Interscholastic Association are taking seriously. And so we are pleased about that, and especially that there will be an independent third-party evaluator who's going to, you know, basically closely assess the nature of the athletics program at Campbell High School. And the settlement also includes other terms that, you know, we are hoping will have broader impact beyond Campbell High School itself, including the development of a Title IX training video that hopefully will be used elsewhere. And so these are all great things. And, you know, we're hoping that the school district uses what it does at Campbell as a model for other schools statewide.
And Ashley, jump in here, you know, because you were a student there at Campbell. And so explain to our listeners what the problem was.
The problem was just overall gender inequity for female athletes. There were common themes that they all struggled with, such as lack of equal opportunities, lack of equipment, facilities, and just overall support from the administration.
Talk about what it was like, what your experience was like as a member of the girls' water polo team.
I would say my team itself made it a positive experience because they were like another family to me. We were all really close. But seeing what they had gone through and what I'd gone through, it was just really frustrating and disheartening. It made me feel like my team and all the hard work we were putting in didn't matter.
You didn't have any facilities to change in. You didn't have access to pools.
And most of the time, our practice facility, the pool, was booked late. So my junior year, we started without having played in a pool at all, and we were practicing on a public beach.
And how far would you have to go to get access to the water?
The beach was close because it was right across the street from the school, but to get to the practice pool took maybe about like 30 to 45 minutes, depending on traffic, sometimes a little bit longer.
And so, Wookie, when you first got wind of this problem, you know, what did you think?
Well, I think we were, quite frankly, we were shocked because, you know, Title IX was passed over 50 years ago now at this point. And to learn that such major inequity still existed today was really shocking and disappointing. And so I learned about this started from a Civil Beat article that revealed that there were about a dozen or so high schools in DOE of the about 55 high schools statewide where there were athletic locker facilities for boys, but not for girls. And so Campbell was one of the, I guess, red flag schools that was noted in that investigation. And so then we started connecting with family members and students, and Ashley and her family stepped forward, and we decided that
we wanted to do something about it.
And it's taken a while, and I don't know, you know, what the landscape is, if this was one of several across the country. You know, I don't know. I mean, what did you find in your research?
Well, I mean, I think across the country, the unfortunate reality is that there is a lot of noncompliance with Title IX in K-12 schools. It's definitely an overlooked issue, or it's an issue that isn't being addressed across the country, and that is disappointing because, you know, obviously schools and your K-12 education is so formative, and if you are already being treated as a second-class citizen from that point, you know, it has a huge impact on your future and sense of self and everything. And, you know, I'm a man, right? But I recognize that the system favors boys and men. And all the research has shown just how significant of an impact playing sports in middle school or high school has, not just on your happiness, but in terms of potential earnings, in terms of developing leadership skills. And so this is not just a frivolous thing that we're talking about. Athletics is a core part of education and of learning and of life. And unfortunately, across the country, there's still a lot of schools and school districts that aren't complying with Title IX when it comes to athletics.
And you folks sought help from a mainland firm that has been involved in a number of these lawsuits.
Yes. So we have been working with an organization called Legal Aid at Work, which is based in California. They have a project that almost exclusively focuses on Title IX athletic advocacy. And so they have brought similar lawsuits in other school districts. And then we're also working with the law firm Simpson, Thatcher & Bartlett, and they have a team there that also focuses on Title IX athletics advocacy because, you know, their leader, Jama Meyer, has a lot of experience in this and, you know, also benefited greatly from Title IX. And all of our co-counsel are athletes as well. And I think that's part of why we were so motivated and are so motivated to work on a case like this, because we've all experienced firsthand how much of an impact sports can have. And I don't know, Ashley, if you want to share sort of the impact that playing sports has had on your life.
For me, sports was always a really important aspect of my life. I grew up playing sports and different kinds of sports ever since I was little. And I would say it's definitely taught me a lot of important life lessons, like teamwork and how to build connections and work towards a goal. My team has always become like my second family. It's taught me like how to build these friendships and personal connections. So it's something that I really value. And to be honest, I really miss playing sports to this day.
So Ashley, you know, how do you think this whole experience has changed you? You know, filing that lawsuit with the ACLU, you know, when you were at Campbell, and then now that you're, you know, in college and, you know, there's a settlement now.
Well, I think it's made me a lot more confident in myself, knowing that myself along with the other plaintiffs on this case were able to make real change, and it's something that goes beyond just us and will benefit future girls and even the current girls right now. And I also feel a sense of pride in that. My younger sister is also one of the plaintiffs.
Your parents, though, must be proud knowing that you've decided to stand up and say this is wrong and, you know, be a part of something that maybe changes things for future athletes.
They've definitely expressed how proud they are of us, and they've been, like, our number one support for all of this and really helpful with this whole process.
And, Wookie, can you talk about how this will look? You know, I know you're still talking with the Department of Education about, you know, the details of a plan.
Well, the parties entered and signed and executed the settlement agreement. It's just a matter of now the court approving the settlement and, you know, because there are certain procedures that need to be followed when it comes to a class action lawsuit. But in short, as far as the next steps, I mean, the parties have already agreed to a particular independent evaluator. And there will be a 7-year compliance and monitoring period during which sort of, you know, there are all these steps that need to be taken as far as doing a site visit, interviewing the students, interviewing the coaches, training the students, training the coaches, et cetera. So that's all contemplated. But just on the mechanics, we're still waiting for the court to finally approve these terms. That will happen sometime in early 2024. The DOE is going to be issuing what is called a class notice. It's basically trying to take reasonable steps to inform any current and future female students at Campbell that might be interested in athletics just about this lawsuit and their rights and whatnot.
So with this lawsuit being a class action, is there a higher standard when it comes to resolving a case like this?
Yes, there is, because essentially a class action is one that is seeking to represent a whole group of people. And typically, the court needs to determine that the settlement is fair. And that's actually sort of the legal term of art, and there's a fairness hearing. And it's about whether it's fair to all the parties involved, and especially the absent class members, meaning class members that did not enter as actual named plaintiffs in the case. And so there's always the opportunity to object, it's called, right? And if they don't agree with the terms of the settlement, or, you know, think it didn't go far enough, or whatever, right? They have that opportunity to present their position to the judge. This is a normal part of most, not all, class actions.
Are there any damages in a case like this?
No, there are no damages that are being sought, and that's one of the reasons why the notice process will pose any issues, because, you know, that's often what the fights are about. Well, you know, there's a $1 million award, or there's a $1 million pot, but why am I only getting 10 cents? Sometimes class members will object on that basis. But no, this lawsuit sought no monetary award, no monetary damages. And so, you know, it was purely about systemic change. And we are pleased that we were able to achieve that.
That was ACLU legal director Wookie Kim and former Campbell High School student Ashley Badis. We spoke in 2023 after they reached a tentative settlement in their lawsuit against the Hawaii Department of Education. The case was about fair access to sports facilities and opportunities in our public schools. Campbell is the largest high school in our state, and the settlement required the school monitor gender equity for girls' sports. Welcome back to The Conversation. Today we're re-airing interviews about Title IX. This past Tuesday marked the 54th anniversary of the mandate passed by Congress and signed into law by President Richard Nixon. June 23, 1972 is a day Marilyn Moniz remembers well. It marked a major shift in societal norms. She was a student at Kaimuki High School when opportunity knocked on her door, leading to so many paths of possibility. Moniz is a former volleyball standout and University of Hawaii athletic administrator who fondly recalls growing up with Title IX.
Title IX really set the course for my life, and it's been my privilege to work with Title IX and have that mandate in federal law, and it allowed me to accomplish so many of my dreams. And that's what it is. It's a dream maker. It's open doors for opportunity for women and men. 50 years ago, it passed in June 23rd, 1972. And I know exactly where I was that made that impact on my life.
Okay, so take us there.
Well, I was down the road here at Kaimuki High School. I have made 18 years old in April. Roe versus Wade had just passed in February. Watergate was happening. And President Richard Nixon signed Title IX into action June 23rd, 1972. In May, I graduated from high school. And I had played volleyball there for 3 years in a row with my other very close teammates. And we were in the gym May, and in comes walking the University of Hawaii very first volleyball coach, Alan Kang, set by the women's athletic director to put a volleyball team together for the University of Hawaii. First time, along with a track program. And that was the beginning of the Rainbow Wahine Athletic Program, which by no coincidence is also celebrating its 50th year of providing opportunities for women to play sports and represent the state of Hawaii. And I got to be one of them because Coach Kang recruited about five of us Kaimuki High School Bulldog players. We were the OIA champions my junior and senior year. And I'm sure in his recruiting research, he found out what schools had strong players and strong programs. We were coached by a female coach at the time who also impacted my life, Coach Anona Napoleon, a surfer and a volleyball player at the time. She had three children already. Two were twins. She put them in the car carrier and put them behind the gymnastics mat, and so she could hit balls at us. So she trained us for 3 years, and we were the OIA championship, which led to the coach coming to recruit us and invite us to play on his team.
Wow, so you were there from the very beginning. What was that experience like for you, knowing that you had doors opening?
It was really awesome, beautiful, wonderful. I mean, women cry when they tell the story because that's the year a lot of them did not have the opportunities to transition from high school to colleges. Not all of them, many of them did not have women's athletics program. That was the time when this law was the impetus for schools to start to add women's athletics. And the University of Hawaii was one of them. And if it wasn't for Dr. Donis Thompson, who worked in the health education recreation department at the time, to take it upon herself because she had come over in the 60s to start a track program for the university. So she had the background and the experience to be able to start an athletic program for us. So we were fortunate to have her there. And she knew Title IX was on the horizon. She was in the national limelight and on committees and in the AIAW, which is the Governing Association for Women Collegiate Sports at the time. So she knew how to leverage it. And she did pretty good in starting the program. Opposition, a lot of opposition. But our men's program was generous enough to provide $5,000 to our women's athletics program so our volleyball program could start and our track program could start.
$5,000 doesn't really go very far.
No, it does not. So they had to be very creative. We didn't really travel the first 2 years. We didn't really have scholarships. By my junior year, we had tuition waivers, which helped a lot. And by my senior year, we recruited our very first three mainland recruits that came in. One from Chicago and two from California to help make our team a stronger team. And my junior and senior year at the University of Hawaii, we were second in the nation to UCLA. We were privileged to go to the national championship because Dr. Donis Thompson raised the money and got some support from the state legislature. And without those women and men, we couldn't have traveled. We went to Portland and took second to UCLA. And in December 75, Adonis and Coach Dave Soji started his career. That was his very first year, was my senior year. And both of them took us to Princeton University to play in our second national championship. And we took second again to UCLA. But the real story there was Dr. Thompson, our women's athletic director, I should just say athletic director, took us down to the national capital, and Representative Patsy Mink and Representative Sparky Matsunaga hosted our team to a lunch, and we talked about volleyball and sports, because she was always an avid sports supporter. I think she played basketball when she was in high school at Maui High. But we took this picture, this classic picture, I have it, on the steps of the national capitol, the team, seven or eight of us, our trainer and Patsy Mann, December 1975. So I treasure that. It's an autograph picture with Patsy in it.
Well, we've just learned that her portrait is going to be unveiled and it will hang in Statuary Hall. So everybody needs to know her contribution to making the dreams of so many young girls, young women come alive. You know, it's a great honor. It's really hard to think that, you know, 50 years has gone by, and yet in schools across the country, even here in Hawaii, that girls' programs, girls' athletic programs are just getting the short shrift, that we have to fight.
That's true. There's still a lot of work to be done. There's progress. Every decade, there's progress. And, you know, for example, my experience at the University of Hawaii, I graduated in 76, and one of the purposes of Title IX was to provide educational opportunities for professional schools for women, because there were quotas at that time in the 70s for women in medical school and law school. And that's one of the things that Patsy had to fight against, because she could not get into medical school. She applied, as I understand, into a dozen medical schools because her dream was to be a doctor. And she ended up, because she couldn't get into medical school, to law school at the University of Chicago. So that's always in the back of her mind as she's championing women's rights and Title IX through this process in the late 60s and the early 70s. And that's when the university's law school and medical school also started in the 70s. So I had the sports experience. I got to play volleyball. I didn't know sitting at Kaimiki Gym in May I'd ever play volleyball competitively, except for maybe club and local women national volleyball, not at a school anymore. But I got that privilege because of her efforts and Dr. Donis Thompson. And so we have to remember that the medical school and the law school, when they started, Title IX was already in effect. And so they didn't have to labor to correct inequities for women at the law school. They could just develop the law school and the medical school, keeping that in mind. And I'm sure the law school's probably 50-50 and the medical school's probably close to that these days. All those efforts started 50 years ago. So I got to go to the UH Law School. You know, and that was awesome because that set the career for me. I was a deputy prosecuting attorney in Maui. Then I went into Parks and Recreation. And then in 89, I came back to the university and I walked in the footsteps of Dr. Donis Thompson because I was the third women's athletic director at the University of Hawaii. So I'm eternally grateful for that opportunity. So I not only played, but I got to be an administrator at the university. And when I got there, we were already in Title IX violation. We already had an investigation in the late 70s and the early 80s. And there were some legal things that happened nationwide. But when I came in 1989, I picked up the mantle, I looked in the files, and I educated myself. What is Title IX? Because I had done my law school paper on Title IX. I didn't know I'd ever become athletic administrator. It happened, and that's why I always say it was just part of my destiny. And I was in the right place, born at the right time, and went to the right high school and then college.
Well, I was just going to ask, you know, what did you see, you know, at the University of Hawaii? What, you know, the battles that you had to, you know, be involved in to kind of get them to be in compliance?
Well, I think the toughest battles when Donis developed the program, because by the time I was a senior at UH Athletics, she had 7 or 8 sports already going, struggling, but already going. So she had the vision. She put the initial programs together. And it was tough working with the men's program at that time because, you know, sometimes we're short-sighted and we see our financial resources, and it's a natural thing not to want your program to suffer. So it was a battle and a struggle. So when I came in 89, Adonis was still there. She was wrapping up a 30-year career at the University of Hawaii. And we put a group together that she had done with Eve Anderson back in the 70s. It was a more of a fundraising support group for women's athletics. We put that little group together because we knew we'd have to have struggle. We'd need to have support behind women's athletics because there was a lot of changes that needed to be done in 89. So Donis kind of gave me a model. She goes, you don't have to be like I was. You can be your own personality and fight the battle in your own way. So I took that to heart because I have to work with all these people.
Right.
We have to figure out how we're going to do this together to build a strong women's athletic program at the University of Hawaii.
Well, what were you, I guess, most proud of in your time there?
I think it's adding 4 to 6 sports along the way, getting people to see what Title IX, educate them and make them aware. We only had 98 Rainbow Wahine in 1989. By the time we finished, we had over 200 because the men had 260 already. So they would be equitable in their participation opportunities because access to the athletic program really is the most important thing. If you don't have access or the opportunity to play your sport, you don't have anything. You can't get scholarships. You can't travel. You can't vie for a championship. You don't have a team and things like that. So to provide, to me, the most important thing was to have the opportunity to play like I had. I was really fortunate to be there at the right place and the right time and people fighting for our opportunity to play.
That was Marilyn Moniz, volleyball standout and UH administrator, talking about the opportunities that Title IX has given her for more than five decades. Moniz was invited to attend the 2022 Hawaii Athletic Directors Association meeting and sharing the stage at a forum were three female high school athletic directors. 30 years ago, there was only one. And in the summer of 2024, we became the 12th state in the country to sanction girls' flag football as a high school varsity sport. The inaugural season kicked off last year and was the first new girls' high school sport in the state in more than two decades.
Got the spirit, we're gonna shout and everyone is gonna hear it. We're gonna shine, we're gonna outshine the rest. Oh yeah.
That does it for today's special Hanaho show about Title IX, as this week we mark 54 years since the act was signed into law. What are your thoughts about Title IX in women's sports? Got a personal story to share? You can call our talkback line. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or reach out on social media. You can listen back to our shows on the conversation page of our website, or you can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and Kevin Allen. Our intern is Addis Belai. And thanks to the HBR Digital team. Our backyard quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.